The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney and our guest today, Dr. Jerome Corsi. Dr. Corsi brings to the table, David, expertise with the relationship between Israel and Iran. Of course, he's published his third book on that issue, Why Israel Can't Wait.
Well, the Middle East has several reference points, Kevin, and for some, you know, the focal point is oil and the steady flow from the region to other parts of the world, and of course that's necessary for the engine of world productivity. For others, the focal point is Iran and the historical shift to a radicalized version of Islam with its motivations to destabilize Israel, destabilize apostate Sunni states, and even cooperate, if not sponsor, regional terrorism. For others still, there's an emphasis, when you're looking at the Middle East, on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Well, and each one of those is very polarizing. I mean, people don't have neutral views on those issues.
We want to look at two elements within the Middle East today which represent flashpoint issues, issues which, were they to develop, would impact the geopolitical landscape and certainly the financial landscape in an instant. You wake up one morning and see the markets trading 5, 10, 15% lower. You wake up one morning and you see oil adding $10 to $20 per barrel in a single trading session. These outcomes are possible in the context of Middle East conflict. And I want to start with Iran. With some background in mind, perhaps, Dr. Corsi, you can share with us the significant events which we should keep in focus when we look at Iran. What are the significant events of the last 3 to 5 years? Have we lost any opportunities to encourage reform in that country?
Well, of course, Israel, I've been following Iran with Israel for a long time. Iran is, just so everyone has clearly a point of reference, Iran is, since the revolution in 1979, Ayatollah Khomeini has been in the hands of a group of very radical Shiite extremists, religious extremists, now headed by Ayatollah Khamenei and President Ahmadinejad. And they have an apocalyptic view that there's the end times, Messiah coming back, Messiah-like figure, the lost 12th Imam, who was a little boy and went down a well, something like it's 790 A.D. It's going to come out of the well, but only when there's a apocalypse happening, a worldwide set of catastrophes, in which Shiite Islam is going to triumph. And Ahmadinejad has even at the United Nations referred to the Mahdi, or this 12th Imam. So as crazy as it seems to articulate this at the beginning of an interview, it's an important frame of reference when you're dealing with Iran, because it's an extremist regime that is pursuing nuclear weapons. And even now the Obama administration has openly disclosed that U.S. intelligence is completely convinced that Iran is on the track of nuclear, developing deliverable nuclear weapons. How long it will take, that's one of the issues we'll discuss. Intelligence estimates vary. I was in Israel last year in 2009 for almost a month in May and June. I wrote my book, Why Israel Can't Wait, The Coming War Between Israel and Iran, and I interviewed nearly all the top leadership of the Israeli government, met President Peres, as well as Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and had extensive detailed interviews, including with two former heads of Mossad. So I've been very well briefed, and I've been very much in touch with Israel as Israel's gone through this now more than first year of the Obama administration, struggling to cope with Iran rising in the region, threatening to get hegemony in the Middle East with the development of nuclear weapons. That's really the background.
Well, Persian culture is perhaps the most alluring and intriguing of any in the Middle East. It is fair to say that the books you've written related to Iran are not anti-Iran at all, but in fact pro-free Iran.
Well, that's clear. I mean, after I wrote Atomic Iran, I walked 200 miles. We had an Iran freedom walk with a group of Iranian expatriates. We walked from the Liberty Bell to Washington, D.C. It took the better part of a month. And these were Iranian expatriates fighting for freedom in their own country. And I've made it very clear, several points of view, which I guess somewhat distinguish me from certain other conservatives. One is I sharply distinguish that the Persian people have a long and distinguished culture going back thousands of years, which is not in any way antagonistic toward the Jews. Jews have lived in Iran for centuries. In fact, if you go to the Bible, the book of Ezra, the Jews were given by Iran, essentially the Persia, what they needed to build the second temple coming out of Babylonian captivity. So there's a long history between a friendship between Persians and Jews that is violated by this radical Islamic regime currently in charge of Iran. And secondly, I guess one of the points where I differ, and it's important to state this, is that I'm clearly on the record as saying that the experience I had with these Iranian expatriates walking and working for their own freedom is that, in my view, there's over a billion people who believe in Islam, and I've had a direct personal experience that these are people who are very peaceful. I do not judge Islam to be a dangerous or difficult religion. I focus and separate the radicals who tend to hijack this religion, as radicals have hijacked other religions at other times. But the vast majority of Muslims, in my experience, are peace-loving. They want to freedom in their own country in Iran. They want to, around the world, grow old in peace, die in their beds surrounded by their family. The problem we have is not Iran or the Persian people. It is this radical extremist regime that funds terror and has an apocalyptic view that Israel can be wiped from the map of the Middle East, as Ahmadinejad says. That's something Israel clearly has got to take into consideration because the current leadership of Iran means it.
Well, demographically speaking, does the present regime represent the majority views, or is there a possibility for regime change internally driven? Is the under, say, 30 years old, the under 30 population, is that radicalized, or are they looking for a new political voice?
Well, this is a key issue. The vast majority of Iran are young, well over 50% of the population under 30 years old. I mean, coming out of the 1980s war with Iraq, so many of the Iranians were killed, down to children, again by the mullahs sending the children into battle ahead of the armies to clear minefields. These radical regimes that have controlled Iran since 1979 have been brutal even on the Iranian people. So Iran has a young population that is not in sympathy with the Muslims or not in sympathy with the mullahs controlling Iran, the clerics who are in charge of Iran's government. In fact, I've been on record many times now since June 2009 when I was in Israel, was the time of the fraudulent presidential election in which Ahmadinejad was fraudulently reelected, and others like Mousavi, who had opposed Ahmadinejad, were again suppressed. The Green Movement, which I'd hoped could be a green revolution of the Iranian people in the streets in Tehran, I think President Obama missed an historic opportunity to reach out to the Green Movement and encourage peaceful change from within in Iran. The only logical way, the best choice, the one I've favored, is not war. I think war is by far the worst policy outcome in the Middle East. For Israel to have to go to war against Iran with or without the United States assistance, this is an indication of failure. What would be the best solution would be for the people within Iran on their own, with only the moral encouragement of countries like the United States, like Ronald Reagan reached out to Lech Walesa in solidarity in the 1980s against the former Soviet Union. If similar moves could be made to support the Green Movement and allow the Green Movement to self-determine in Iran the future direction of Iran that would moderate the regime away from these radical clerics currently hijacking Iran and hijacking Islam in Iran, this is the best possible solution to the Iranian emergence within the Middle East. But now I think that's not going to happen.
Yeah, let's talk about that. You make the comparison between the Reagan administration and their stance with Poland. You're saying there's a difference between the Obama administration's stance with Iran today. How should the United States be positioned in relation to these student groups that have protested the election?
Well, first of all, the United States has got to realize that we're going to be blamed by the mullahs no matter what we do with Iran. Once they've got street demonstrations, the mullahs, the Ahmadinejad, the others in the regime, are going to put out the word that this was a CIA-instigated revolt against the regime, whether or not it was. The United States is going to be blamed. If we're dealing with Iran, I don't think a moral neutral point of view is possible. I think we have to stand on the side of freedom and stand on the side of those people within Iran who want their own freedom. Why I walked with the expatriates who want freedom in Iran. This is not a value-neutral situation. This Iranian regime is brutal to its own people. I walked with Iranian expatriates who were sending money back into Iran so Iranian women would not have to sell one of their daughters into sex slavery to feed the other children. It's a brutal regime. It suppressed the people of Iran, reduced their economic horizon, induced poverty among the people of Iran, where there should be considerable middle-class economic security with the oil resources and natural gas that Iran has. The Iranian people are very productive. They're very successful in the United States. This regime, however, just like Ronald Reagan saying, and he was condemned for it at the time, that the Soviet Union was an evil empire and that we needed to stand up for the forces of freedom, like Valenza. I think similarly, we've got to take the position in Iran. It's, to me, bizarre that we might be contemplating going to war with Iran as a last resort, using a military option, but yet we wouldn't in advance take a moral position and say we'd support a green movement if it were leading to a regime change. Our State Department refuses to declare regime change as our policy towards Iran, and I think that's a fatal flaw in our ability to deal with Iran in a peaceful and productive way.
Where should U.S. foreign policy be focused if we and or Israel want to avoid outright conflict with Iran? Can we play a role in the outcome? What role are we playing now?
I think certainly. I mean, Israel has been, I've had repeated contacts with Israel going back to 2005 on the Iranian question at the various highest levels of the government. And I can, my assessment is that the Israeli government does not want to go to war with Iran. Israel realizes the severity and the unpredictable nature of a war with Iran. And Israel has been begging the world community to unite and impose meaningful sanctions. Now, meaningful sanctions would mean, among other things, restricting Iran's access to gasoline. The mullahs and the clerics run Iran's oil industry so miserably that they can't even refine enough of the crude oil they have to produce sufficient gasoline supplies for the Iranian population to use domestically. Iran imports gasoline. We could work on the financial restrictions, the banking arrangements that Iran continues to utilize. When I wrote Why Israel Can't Wait, I'm pointing out any number of banking arrangements that Iran utilizes in Western Europe, around indirectly into the United States, through foundations, through other groups. We've attempted to shut down some of these, but by no means has Iran, Western Europeans continue to actively do business with Iran. Germany's been very involved, even to provide Iran assistance with its nuclear industry. These ties have got to be shut down. Russia and China both actively support Iran, Russia even with military assistance. Russia continues to contemplate selling some very advanced surface air missile defense systems to Iran, and China is a major partner in oil and natural gas purchased from Iran. With these ties economically, we're not going to get meaningful sanctions. But meaningful sanctions like we applied against South Africa, when the world again united morally to condemn apartheid, the world has not got a similar unification in terms of the corrupt nature of this Iranian regime, its injustice to the Iranian people, and its threat that it raises to Israel.
Well, obviously, Iran and the move to develop nuclear capability adds a dimension of stress in the region. You need three things to be a serious nuclear threat: fissile material, a delivery system, and lastly, the technology to improve that fissile material to a weapons grade or a form that's usable for tactical purposes. Do they have, or how close is the Iranian government to having all three?
Well, since the Obama administration has come into office, it's clear, even from looking at the International Atomic Energy Agency report, that Iran is now accelerating its program to enrich uranium. A second facility that was previously secret has now been openly admitted. I'm hearing there's at least a third facility enriching uranium in Iran. Iran is now using a higher, more advanced form of centrifuge that Iran has re-engineered and produced on their own. Iran's going to be capable of enriching weapons-grade uranium almost any time it wants. It may take it a while, but it's moving in that direction. Missile technology, it's clear that Iran has missiles capable of hitting Israel. Iran has launched, since the Obama administration has come into office, satellites into space successfully. And then the third component, which is really developing the weaponized uranium in a probably a metallized form that can fit within a warhead. Again, U.S. intelligence has verified that Iran has the technical know-how. They've identified, they've gotten the in their computers the technical information needed to provide to produce a warhead. We've also been able to validate they've been buying components which are used in warhead design. It's pretty clear that Iran is testing warhead development. So again, these three kind of components, Iran multiply is tracking these different components which ultimately have to come together to produce a deliverable nuclear weapon. And as I say, it's the intelligence sources I've met with, including two former heads of Mossad, now openly declaring in the Obama administration, revising the previous national intelligence estimate, which had indicated that Iran had stopped their nuclear program in 2003. That estimate came out during the Bush administration, I believe in 2006. That assessment of the U.S. intelligence agencies is no longer operative. U.S. intelligence believes that Iran also is moving in a very fast track to developing a nuclear weapon. Whether that's 1 year or 2 year or 3 year time span, I think the Israeli intelligence probably will be the best in the world to estimate that, but it certainly continues to be on a very fast track.
Once again, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com.
Well, there's an interesting connection that you point out in your book between Iran and Hamas on the one hand, and Iran and Hezbollah on the other hand. And again, talking about stress in the region as it relates to Iran and Israel, there's the element which is nuclear. There's also the element with these groups which are a part of Israel's daily existence. Maybe you can explore what those connections are between Iran and those two groups.
Well, Hezbollah is a terrorist organization. It was created by Iran going back into the 1980s, and Hezbollah has its roots probably even before the 1980s when I think about it, because it was Ayatollah Khomeini when he was in exile, so that would have put it before 1979, working to create this organization, Hezbollah, which has taken seed and holds power now in southern Lebanon. And, of course, Hamas, which is not a Shiite organization, its origins are out of the Egyptian Brotherhood. It's a Sunni organization. But yet, after Hamas won the parliamentary elections in 2006 in the Gaza, and taking power in the Gaza, the Israelis and the United States quit funding Hamas, and Iran filled the vacuum. And again, Iran has been supplying both Hezbollah with rockets, largely through Syria, and Hamas with rockets that can hit Israel, largely coming through Egypt, and the entrance into the Gaza through Egypt. It's been very concerning to Egypt, because now there's Hamas presence in the Sinai, which did not used to be the case.
Now, are we talking about dozens of rockets? Are we talking about hundreds of rockets?
My estimates are Hezbollah may have as many as 12 or 15,000 rockets now, capable of reaching longer range, capable of reaching not only Tel Aviv, but Jerusalem, which also means they can reach Ben-Gurion Airport in Israel and put Israel's only international airport out of service. I don't have as precise an estimate of the number of rockets in Hamas, but I would guess it's about 5,000 or 6,000. That would include some very primitive kind of Kassan rockets, almost homemade, in addition to some longer-range rockets. But the real long-range threat for rockets comes out of Hezbollah in Lebanon, mostly to northern Israel. But then again, from Hamas, you can have significant damage and threat to life from the rockets that would be launched by Hamas out of the Gaza. At thousands of rockets resupplied since the Second Lebanon War, and also since Operation Cast Lead, which was the incursion of Israel into Gaza to try to control Hamas. The resupplying of rockets has been an aggressive process, and that's constantly a threat. At any time, a war that ultimately could end up being a war with Iran could start by Israel going after rockets in southern Lebanon or in the Gaza.
But we're not talking about a limited commitment from Lebanon or from Syria, or there being direct Syrian involvement. What we're talking about is direct involvement with Iran, either from the funding side or the actual sourcing of materials.
Right. Iran provides both funding and rockets. Syria, I believe, increasingly is providing rockets as well. There's some new intelligence indicating that Syria stepped up that. And Israel has also increased the militarization of the Golan Heights, which I was very surprised to see when I was in Israel in 2009, how much stepped up the Israeli military presence is monitoring Syria. Syria is, I think, increasingly concerned, Israel's increasingly concerned that if there were a war with Iran, it would not only involve Hezbollah, Hamas, but it would involve Syria. You know, Israel's got to feel, when I was in Israel, there was major air raids run. It was clear, nationwide air raid, first time I'd ever experienced that in Israel. And it was clear that the Israeli government, even from the conversations I had with the Israeli government officials, General Yalon, Vice Prime Minister, made it clear that Israel anticipates there would be thousands of Israeli casualties, if only from the rocket attacks. And a war, Israel launched war on Iran, is not a video game. There's larger distances involved in hitting Osirik, which Israel successfully did in the 1980s, or just a few years ago hitting a Syrian nuclear facility and wiping it out. These distances and the more sophistication of Iran with surface-to-air missiles largely supplied by Russia, and the potential of an expanding war, a war that could involve Russia defending Iran or China entering on the side of Iran, a retaliation by Syria, retaliation by Hezbollah, by Hamas. The Israelis make it very clear that if there is a war launched on Iran by Israel, it will be because Israel feels totally abandoned in the international setting, and that Israel feels that it's imminent that Iran will have a deliverable nuclear weapon that could be detonated over Tel Aviv. When those configurations come together, Israel will exercise a right of self-defense, and with or without the United States' approval, launch a military strike against Iran, which I think will be catastrophic to the region and to all the countries involved. I'm not assured of its success. And Egypt and Saudi Arabia very quietly are working with Israel, equally concerned as Sunni nations, that Iran not get nuclear weapons, because the Shiite hegemony through nuclear weapons in the region from Iran is ultimately a threat to the stability of the Saudi Arabian government and the Egyptian government, as it is a threat to the Israeli government.
Well, you said abandoned. That would be a precursor to Israel having to look at the situation very differently. You get Germany with significant contracts in Iran. You've got France, as you mentioned earlier. You've got Russia, China. There's a growing number of people on the UN Security Council, including the U.S. and our current administration, who, at least according to polls within Israel, is not necessarily a supporter of Israel. I don't know if that's the case or not, but at least the polls in Israel would indicate they have no confidence in the present administration to be a significant backstop to the state of Israel. Aren't we already talking about a pretty much abandoned state?
We are. I'll go even further. I mean, in private conversations, and I did report it in Why Israel Can't Wait, Israeli government officials are very concerned that the Obama administration is tilting to the Palestinian, to the radical Palestinian. When I was in Israel, during the time, May, June last year, when President Obama went to Cairo and declared that he'd experienced Islam on three continents, when I wrote the Obama Nation and pointed out President Obama's Islamic roots, I was excoriated for mentioning his involvement, that he actually had Islamic instruction when he was a child in Indonesia. The first to prove that, even up to that point, the Obama campaign had denied that, but I had the record and I had the testimony coming out of Indonesia that I published in the Obama Nation. Well, that was very well perceived in Israel. The photographs were in the Israeli papers when that speech was given in Cairo by President Obama of Hamas with their AK-47s and their head masks sitting, listening on fold-up chairs within Hamas offices to to Obama giving the speech on television. Those photographs were published in the Israeli papers. The United States entering into the negotiations, pressuring Israel on settlements, not just natural growth settlements in the West Bank, but even settlements in Jerusalem. And I spent almost 2 hours with Ambassador Dory Gold in his office in Jerusalem. And Dory Gold was saying, look, we have agreements here, including with the Bush administration, that these natural growth settlements and the developments we're doing in Jerusalem were agreed to. And I pointed out to Dory Gold that I didn't think the Obama administration would feel bound by any previous administration's agreements diplomatically with Israel. And that's largely turned out to be the case. A one-sided pushing Israel to make concessions on developments, even the Saudis have told the Obama administration, they told Hillary Clinton directly, and I reported it in WorldNet Daily, that the issue is not settlement in Jerusalem. The issue really ultimately is Iran building nuclear weapons. Now, the Jews have been building in Jerusalem for 2,000 years. And the settlement of the Palestinian question, even if a two states were created, would not reduce Iran's determination to see Israel wiped from the map of the Middle East. That's one of those issues that American diplomacy sometimes gets confused on, that if we were able to settle the Palestinian question, we would have a new burst of peace in the region, not as long as Iran remains under the control of the radical Islamic regime, the Shiite regime of religious fanatics.
And that really largely, Dr. Corsi, is why with so many different places to put an emphasis in discussing the Middle East, you know, today's conversation we focus on Iran and Israel because Iran is the X factor you can't necessarily control. We've got the cult of personality on the one hand. We've got the possibility of an internally generated regime change given the demographics and the student movement there. I mean, there's a number of things which are actually quite positive, both for Middle Eastern peace and sort of market and world tranquility in light of what happens. But, you know, looking at sort of the morning after, this is perhaps a work of imagination, but what does Israel have to lose in a preemptive strike? What does the next 3 to 6 months look like in the Middle East following an Israeli first strike?
Well, and first of all, I want to point out that I've been reading published State Department and U.S. military joint force assessments for a long time, for years, that continually make it clear that the major threat in the Middle East is Iran, that Iran is the terror master, as it were, in the Middle East. So this kind of focus on Iran, not even on the Palestinians, is the issue, I think is something that when you carefully read our government reports on the Middle East, that our government, the State Department, and the military will acknowledge. Now, to answer your question, if a war begins between Israel and Iran, I can't emphasize enough that it's unpredictable. It may not be short. Iran has many different installations, at least 30 that would have to be probably taken out to slow Iran's nuclear program down at this point. Iran would come out of a war if Israel launched it preemptively, saying, look, now we're justified in having nuclear weapons as defensive measures. So, ironically, an Israeli attack on Iran in self-defense would provide justification for Iran resuming at a more open and aggressive, even yet aggressive, level their nuclear program once the attack was over. Destabilization from Hamas and Hezbollah, Iran would be wanting their surrogates, terrorist organizations, to launch rocket attacks on Israel. Israel would have to go into Lebanon again with another military incursion against Hezbollah and another incursion similar to Operation Cast Lead in the Gaza. The economic impact from Israel's economy would largely just shut down while the war was going on. The Straits of Hormuz, which very easily Iran can harass or shut down, something like 40% of the world's oil supply passes through the Straits of Hormuz every day. Oil prices would instantly spike. Oil over $100 a barrel would be almost a certainty, now trading around $83 to $85 a barrel. We'd be headed back towards $145 a barrel, which is the all-time high. And the economic consequences in a world that's struggling to recover from one of the worst global recessions since the 1930s, from this kind of a conflict would be a huge economic setback, to say nothing of the human cost involved and loss of life in the Middle East. So it's unpredictable. And the United States may or may not enter on the side of Israel. The United States certainly could be expected to apply diplomatic and economic pressure almost immediately to Israel to get Israel to stop the military action. It's uncertain whether the people in Iran would rise up against the regime. It would depend on how solidly the regime looked at, as if it were in power. And remember, the people in Iran take a great personal risk, protest in the streets. After any of these demonstrations, they're photographed, leaders are rounded up, they disappear in Iranian prisons and are never heard of again. They're brutally tortured and murdered. This is the way the Iranian regime maintains control over the people of Iran. So anyone who would want a war, I think, would have to just not appreciate the dire consequences and the unpredictability of a war, which is why I think I've been predicting, since I wrote Atomic Iran, that a war would occur. But it does not mean I'm in favor of a war. I've been predicting it so the world could focus on realizing that other alternatives need to be pursued or a war is going to happen. And if a war happens, I think going to be extremely difficult to get the Middle East back into a stable situation anytime soon.
Looking at the human cost, 20 to 30% potentially of the population in Israel in the midst of dealing with, as you say, the surrogate issues, Lebanon, Gaza, Hezbollah and Hamas being almost, you know, almost a blowback response as a part of Iran's thrust or response back, if only surreptitiously. This is interesting. We've got a lot at stake.
I'd also add into it Syria. Remember, the Druze population, which is very strong in the Golan Heights, is solidly pro-Syrian. And that Druze population, together with the Syrian, if you look back to former Israeli wars, going back to 1973, the Golan Heights and the tank battles in the Golan Heights are legendary. And those tank battles could occur again, or tank rocket battles. I mean, the casualties throughout the region, whether Israel would retaliate on Damascus or not, I don't know. But, I mean, these are the problems. Regional wars have a way of expanding. If Damascus were involved attacking the Golan Heights, Israel retaliates against Damascus. Now you've got an expanding regional situation that puts much more pressure on Egypt and Saudi Arabia not to openly support Israel, which they probably couldn't do. But if the United States is not giving airspace to Israel over Iraq, the alternative would be to use airspace over Saudi Arabia, which will be less available if, in fact, Syria got into the conflict and it were being preserved. And Lebanon would most likely now support Hezbollah. Hezbollah solidly controls southern Lebanon, and it controls a major position in the Lebanon parliament.
Dr. Corsi, I'm not a particular fan of our foreign policy over the last 15 to 20 years, where it seems like destabilization and regime change have been front and center. And sometimes we get it right and sometimes we get it wrong. And on a moral basis, I don't know that it's justified from the get-go. But this certainly looks like a scenario where regime change and the CIA doing what they used to do, doing it unabashedly, and seeing a regime change in Iran could be the best thing that we did for a long time in terms of our foreign policy.
I don't think you need the CIA. I think that all you need to support the Green Movement, in fact, I wouldn't use the CIA. I wouldn't use U.S. intelligence in terms of active involvement to destabilize Iran. I think Iran is ready to be destabilized internally by its own people. Moral suasion is sufficient. The CIA could have provided material to the dissidents. I mean, the State Department would have been the better way to do it. But the State Department has consistently refused to support financially the many different expatriate Iranian groups that have wanted to send computers, satellite dishes, coffee machines, cell phones, cameras. These are the resources the Iranian people need more than any. And quite frankly, when the Green Movement was operating in June with the cameras within cell phones and using Twitter and Facebook were sufficient for the Green Movement to communicate. They didn't need any satellite telephone supplied by the CIA or the State Department. I think the technology is sufficient right now in Iran for the people to communicate and to get into the streets if they knew the world was supporting them, if they knew that the United States was going to focus on the regime, naming dissidents who were captured and put into prison. President Obama, during the June uprising in Iran, gave many statements saying, we don't want to interfere, we don't want to intervene, we don't want to be perceived to have taken the side, one side or the other here. But as I pointed out earlier, we were perceived anyway to have supported the Green Movement and to have been able to do it with moral suasion. I think the threshold we need to cross here with Iran is a moral issue, that we're going to support the Green Movement, but not militarily, not CIA, not surreptitiously. I don't think we need to do any of that. We did any supporting we could support through the State Department, the many efforts from expatriate Iranians around the world that want some limited resources to help their own people.
So it sounds as if the Obama administration is going to have to step out, and if it is going to be a clear voice in terms of world leadership, move from a morally neutral position to a judgment of this is reality. This is where people are experiencing pain and a lack of freedom, and it's unacceptable.
Well, I think we've got a fundamental problem with the Obama administration, and that is that my reading of President Obama from the very beginning, from when I wrote The Obama Nation, is that his sympathies are Muslim. And I've stated that unabashedly. He has deep experience in Chicago with Rashid Khalidi and other very radical pro-Palestinian forces. And President Obama wanted to negotiate with Ahmadinejad. That was a terrible failure, which I predicted it would be. And these efforts to reach out to a Muslim world have, I think, produced very little results for the Obama administration. Because the Muslim world is not going to react, except like Ahmadinejad, to see that as an indication of U.S. weakness. We could reach out to the moderate Islamic forces by supporting the Green Movement and still not be making statements that are anti-Islam. I don't think we need to be making anti-Islamic statements. I think we need to make the kind of distinctions I made earlier, which is to say, look, we accept Islam as a religion that a billion people believe in, vast majority, peacefully. We're not at war with Islam. We're at war with this clique of religious fanatics that have captured Iran since 1979 and are now dangerous not only to their own people but to the region since they're pursuing nuclear weapons. We need to focus and isolate our attention there. But President Obama's got to be willing to cross the line and realize that he can't talk to Ahmadinejad. He's not going to persuade. Ahmadinejad ridicules Barack Obama. He's made some of the most scurrilous statements about Barack Obama's incompetence that if I were to make those comparable statements, I'd be excoriated for making. Ahmadinejad makes them openly almost daily because he has no respect for President Obama at this point. And Ahmadinejad is correct. The Obama administration has no plan to stop Iran from developing nuclear power in whatever direction Iran wants to develop it, including militarily. So the Obama administration likes to portray their coming into power as renewed respect for the United States worldwide. It is not the case. In the Middle East, we have dramatically lost respect because we are rudderless. We are without a plan that has any chance of any success, given the goals we've stated we want to achieve.
And you see that as indicated by Egypt and Saudi Arabia.
Correct.
And Israel, three interesting countries to be sitting down across the table from each other and discussing survival strategies and how to prosper in a time where there is this Shiite Islamic triumphalism just around the corner, just at the end of the neighborhood.
Right, and when you've got Israel moving nuclear submarines through the Suez Canal or missile frigates, you know that that requires coordination. That just, you know, it's not because the Suez Canal is not busy that day. It requires detailed coordination between the Israeli and the Egyptian governments, their military, and their military intelligence for that kind of a ship to move, Israeli warship to move through the Suez Canal from the Mediterranean into the Gulf region. That's a clear sign to Iran, and it's read as such.
Well, I appreciate your insights on this issue, and we'll look forward to future conversations. I hope and pray, as you have suggested, that this never happens, and that through diplomacy and great wisdom, both for the sake of Israel and the stability of the rest of the Middle East, that these issues can be sorted out in means other than militarily. So thank you for joining us, and we'll look forward to having you back on the program.
Thanks, David. Always a great honor and pleasure, and I agree with your concluding statement. I'd like to see peace in this region, and a war will be something we should take great steps to avoid.
Well, David, that was another fascinating talk with Dr. Corsi. You know, talking about why we would actually bring this issue onto the table right now with our listeners, Iran, Israel, and the variability of how this thing could turn out. You know, you've got an awful lot of people right now who are predicting war and a preemptive strike from Israel without really thinking of the ramifications afterwards. But there's another outcome. There are several other outcomes that we need to investigate, especially if we're being fair right now.
Well, I think the issue for us, Kevin, is getting a deeper understanding of the Middle East. This last year, our interview with Bernard Lewis, Middle Eastern scholar from Princeton University, you know, again, a deeper appreciation for some of the complexities, differentiating Shiite and Sunni, looking at some of the radical elements within Islam, and looking at them as standalone elements, not at all sort of painting with a broad brushstroke and saying the whole Islamic world is to blame for what could be Middle Eastern instability.
Well, like you said, it's actually a tail wagging the dog type of scenario. I mean, when you were talking about a cult of personality, what we've got right now is we've got an administrations that are regimes that are actually holding power and doing things against the populace will.
This is, I think, one of the things that's particularly encouraging to me. There's very few places in the world where you can have 100% control in a world where technology has made communication so free-flowing.
Mm-hmm.
The vision of what the world can be in light of people having cell phones, internet connections, cable TV, we may look at the moral and social impacts of those things as somewhat negative in an advanced culture. But if you contrast Iran versus North Korea, there is no technological inputs in a place like North Korea. It is a place that is locked down, that is bleak, and remains probably one of the greatest threats in the world today because no one knows different inside the country.
Yeah.
And there's no one internally who would know different or be driving towards something different than the existing regime.
Whereas with Iran.
Exactly.
Yeah, where we were getting YouTube pictures of the protests last June and July, rather.
We're in an interesting period in time. I don't think the current administration in Iran can hold on forever. Because again, if 70% of the population is under the age of 30,
mm-hmm.
and they have an idea of the good life which is different than a radicalized version of Islam, guess what? The history of Persia is rich. The minds, it really is, to do a study of Persia in the last 2,000 years, it is one of the richest cultures on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And having personal friends from Iran and having interaction with a lot of Iranian Americans, there is a huge desire to see Persian culture, the Farsi language, poetry, flourish as it once did. And there is a regime in place which doesn't allow for that to happen. It doesn't allow for that richness of culture to be expressed. But I think given technology, we are on the cusp of change. And actually, you know, Why Israel Can't Wait, the book that Jerome Corsi wrote, and Atomic Iran, these are real issues. And I think there may be an outcome other than, and I'm certainly hopeful that there's an outcome other than war.
Well, and let's face it, if you're Ahmadinejad or you're one of the Ayatollahs, it's a race against time because you've got this population that right now no longer responds to the radical Islam terrorist regime.
They're not interested.
No. So they need to get this nuclear program going as quickly as possible and actually probably need Israel to first strike.
Kevin, that would be a polarizing event wherein 70% of the population who is young and perhaps uninterested in their present regime would all of a sudden have a reason to fight and have a reason to say, you know, we've been attacked and we collectively need to defend ourselves. That could be one of the most catastrophic things for the Middle East. And so it is frustrating to see U.S. foreign policy sort of stumble on this point and not, in fact, see what would be sort of an organic change within the country as a way of cutting off potential conflict.
Well, and David, as you've discussed with me here recently, you'd like to keep this issue on the front burner now for the next couple of months. I know you're planning on going to Israel in June. You've got some high-level meetings that you're planning on delving deeper into the subject. Why don't you give the listeners just an idea of why and what you're thinking on that?
Well, as you look at the economy and look at the world picture, there's a couple of things that you can see. If you're looking at general macro economics or global thematics, if you will, These are things which appear to be in place and developing over a course of time, whether that's the growth in Asia, whether that's demographic shifts in a given country, Western and Eastern Europe as an example.
Or the Middle East.
Inflation, deflation. These are some themes that you can begin to build a case for developing and developing ahead of steam kind of on a cumulative basis. The issue with the Middle East is very different.
Mm-hmm.
The Middle East is, for me, an X factor. You don't know if something will or will not happen, but if it were to happen, would have
it'd be catastrophic,
dramatic impact into the marketplace. So to understand what is going on behind the scenes from an Islamic perspective, from an Israeli perspective, this is very important to me. But again, it's very different than the themes that we may also explore and develop relating to China, relating to Eastern Europe, relating to the Soviet Union, relating to so many other themes that we explore on a regular basis.
Well, and I know you plan on talking about China and, of course, the economy, but the Middle East right now will be a focus. And we would encourage the listeners to continue to listen in because we think we'll probably find some things that aren't in the normal news. You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney and our guest today, Dr. Jerome Corsi. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.